The judge sided with us on about 85% of the territory that's in dispute.
Movement in the lawsuit over billboards and campaign signs. From Alaska Public Media, this is statewide news on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, September 10th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, Alaskans on both sides of the abortion debate don't think protections in the state are going away anytime soon.
Basically, Alaska provides more protection for abortion rights than does the federal constitution.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. And by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at matson.com.
A massive search continues in Kotzebue for a missing 10-year-old girl. Alaska State Troopers report that Ashley Johnson Barr was last seen leaving a local park at 6 o'clock Thursday evening. A statement issued by Kotzebue Police on Saturday says Johnson Barr's cell phone was found on a city street about a half mile from the park in the opposite direction of the route to her home. Numerous agencies are involved in the search, including Arctic Circle Search and Rescue, the Northwest Arctic Burrow Search and Rescue, the Coast Guard, Matsu-based search dog teams, and hundreds of volunteers. The FBI said Monday that several special agents were also assisting. A state incident management team organized the first searches over the weekend, mostly on foot. It's included a grid search of the city, surrounding area campsites, and structures. Some campaign signs on private property along Alaska's highways can be displayed for now. That's after a judge issued a temporary restraining order today, stopping the state from removing signs outside the state's right-of-way. But Superior Court Judge Herman Walker's order allows the state to continue to enforce the ban within the state's right-of-way. That's as long as the state treats political and commercial signs the same. Assistant Attorney General Mike Schechter says the order allows the state to protect public safety.
The judge's order does essentially what the state requested, which is make clear that folks are allowed to place small temporary political campaign signs on their private property and allows the state to continue enforcing restrictions on signage within the right-of-way.
Signs were removed under a highway billboard ban in existence since before statehood. The American Civil Liberties Union of Alaska, the campaign group Dunleavy for Alaska, and Palmer resident Eric Siebels had sued the State Department of Transportation for removing them in July. ACLU spokesperson Casey Reynolds says he's pleased.
The judge sided with us on about 85% of the territory that's in dispute and is going to issue a separate ruling on the remainder in the next couple of weeks.
The ACLU says its intent was not to lift the ban on commercial billboards, but the lawsuit challenges the ban's constitutionality. The judge indicated a second order with further guidance on enforcing the ban will be forthcoming. In a hastily assembled early morning press conference today, state officials announced that they have settled on terms of a gas sales agreement with ExxonMobil. The agreement is not binding, but is intended to supply gas for the Alaska LNG project. The state would not share a copy of the agreement, but officials say it contains key terms like the price for the gas and volume the company agrees to sell. The project would build a pipeline to bring gas from the North Slope to Cook Inlet for export. The state's Gas Line Corporation is negotiating at both ends of its proposed pipeline, including final agreements to buy gas from producers and contracts for buyers for that gas. The gas sales agreement is also linked to production at the massive Point Thompson field on the North Slope. Exxon operates the field, though BP is a major owner as well. Production at the field has been a point of contention between the state and the oil companies for decades. A 2012 legal agreement set a timeline for bumping up production. Now, the state has agreed to suspend that timeline, so long as ExxonMobil and BP continue to negotiate gas sales agreements for the Alaska LNG project. The Gasline Corporation still needs to secure the federal and state permits to build the $45 billion project. It wants a final investment decision by 2019, so it can break ground that year and bring the project online by 2025. With the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to the U.S. Supreme Court pending in the Senate, many Americans are hoping, and others dreading, that the court could consider the legal right of women to terminate a pregnancy as established in Roe v. Wade. If the 1973 case is overturned, states would have more power to restrict abortion or possibly ban the procedure entirely within their boundaries. But in Alaska, the right to abortion is stronger than it is in most of the country. Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin explores why that is.
I put the question to attorneys on both sides of the issue.
What happens in Alaska if Roe v. Wade is overturned?
Well, the answer basically is nothing.
That's Anchorage attorney Kevin Clarkson. He says the state constitution, as interpreted by the Alaska Supreme Court, affirms a legal right that amounts to Roe v. Wade on steroids.
Basically, Alaska provides more protection for abortion rights than does the federal constitution. So if Roe versus Wade were overturned in Alaska, nothing would change.
And as he sees it, that's a problem. Clarkson has represented the anti-abortion side in several Alaska cases. He's defended a law requiring parental consent before a minor's abortion, and when that was deemed unconstitutional, he defended one requiring parental notification. The state Supreme Court found that one unconstitutional, too. Again and again, he and other abortion opponents have hit a brick wall called the Alaska Constitution. And Clarkson says the biggest brick in it is the Privacy Amendment. Roe v. Wade is built on the U.S. Supreme Court's finding of an implied right to privacy in the national constitution. But months before Roe in 1972, Alaska voters installed that right explicitly in their own state constitution. It's there in black and white. The right of the people to privacy is recognized and shall not be infringed.
Although I think if you looked at the history of the Privacy Amendment in Alaska, it would be pretty clear that nobody had abortion in mind when they passed that amendment.
Clarkson is right that abortion wasn't the commonly stated reason for Alaska's privacy amendment. According to a history published by the Legislative Affairs Agency, the issue of the day was the state's development of a database to track people's criminal histories. Regardless of what sparked it, the state Supreme Court says the intent of the privacy amendment was much broader. And that's how former state Senate President Chancey Croft remembers it, too.
Nobody really knew where it came from, but it just struck everybody pretty well unanimously, like this was a good idea and it really fits in Alaska.
Croft says legislators in 1972 liked the spirit of the Privacy Amendment, even if the exact motivation behind it was something of a mystery. He and the rest of the legislature put the Privacy Amendment on the ballot, and voters approved it by a huge margin. For a long time, Alaska's privacy protection seemed to be mostly linked to marijuana. That's because soon after the amendment passed, an attorney named Irwin Raven got arrested with some cannabis in his pocket. The Alaska justices concluded it was none of the government's business if a person had a small amount of marijuana at home. It wasn't until 1997 that the Alaska Supreme Court had an opportunity to say the right of privacy covered abortion, too.
Not only does this provision protect reproductive rights, it protects them as a fundamental right, which means that they get the highest level of protection.
Attorney Janet Kreps of the Center for Reproductive Rights has worked on most of the important Alaska abortion cases. Kreps says about a dozen state constitutions around the country have a right to privacy or something similar, but their courts don't necessarily apply it in abortion cases the way Alaska's does. For instance, Kreps says,
Louisiana has a constitutional right to privacy, and the court has said that it doesn't provide any extra protection.
She agrees with Clarkson, the anti-abortion attorney, that if Roe v. Wade falls, it won't change anything for women in Alaska.
That won't be the case for women in other parts of the country.
But what if you want abortion banned or limited in Alaska? Clarkson is resigned to the idea that his side will continue to lose abortion cases in the Alaska Supreme Court, usually on privacy grounds. The only way to really limit abortion in Alaska, he says, is by constitutional amendment. Reporting from Anchorage, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, after nearly a year closed, Sitka's public assistance office reopens.
It's not such a bottleneck now, but it definitely hit Sitka hard and it hit families hard.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Want a fulfilling volunteer opportunity educating and protecting your community? As a trained Medicare counselor, you'll help stop fraud and connect people with the benefits they've earned. You can make a powerful difference for Alaska seniors. Learn more at medicare.alaska.gov or call Alaska's Medicare Information Office at 800-478-6065. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Alaska Airlines workers picketed at airports across the West Coast today. They're upset over slow-moving contract negotiations. In Juneau, clerical workers, ramp staff, and customer service agents represented by the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers sported neon green t-shirts that said, "Show us the money," as they waved signs on the plaza across from the airport's drop-off area. John Walters works on the ramp for Alaska Airlines at Juneau International Airport. He and about 20 other union employees and supporters demonstrated for most of the day.
Job security is number one. Our job is not guaranteed. We live contract to contract, so job security is huge. Pension, raise, our starting pay is $12 an hour. We don't get paid much to do this job.
According to union representatives, Juneau's demonstration was one of 10 in cities across the West Coast. Workers in Anchorage and Fairbanks also picketed. All of the participants took part before or after work on or on their day off. The president of Juneau's local chapter 2202, Caleb Rosa, said they first approached the airline more than a year ago about opening up contract negotiations.
It's going, but it's going slowly, and we're doing it as clean as possible. We love the place we work. We love our work group. We love our co-workers and the company we work for.
Rosa explained that the union cannot strike without congressional approval due to the Railway Labor Act. Instead, they're hoping to put public pressure on Alaska Airlines.
We'll take all support we can get, but if Alaska doesn't move this process along quicker, then we're going to have to start engaging the public on a daily basis.
In a statement, Alaska Airlines confirmed it is in the process of negotiating two labor agreements with the union. The airline said it does not talk about specifics during union negotiations, but it supports paying employees fair, competitive wages and offering quality benefits. Alaska highway workers have moved the Dalton Highway away from a gigantic mass of frozen debris that is oozing down a hillside. Transportation officials say the roughly mile-long frozen debris lobe, consisting of dirt, ice, and trees, would threaten a section of the road more than 200 miles north of Fairbanks within 3 to 4 years. Motorists were reportedly rerouted onto the new gravel road starting August 31st. Jeff Curry with the Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities says the project cost the state about $2 million. It will be 20 or so years until the debris lobe is expected to threaten the road again. A pair of duck hunters in northwest Alaska stumbled upon a 177-pound woolly mammoth tusk sticking out of the ground. The Associated Press reports Justin Schultze and Brandon Noyukpuk dug the 12-foot tusk out of the ground earlier this month near the village of Shishmaref on the Chukchi Sea coast. After digging for about a half hour, the pair loaded the tusk into a skiff to lug home. Schultze says about half the village of 600 people has visited his house in recent days to see the polished amber-like tusk. He says the tusk's center is encircled with dark ribbons and the tip appears gray and dull. Schultze says he has already sold it to an Anchorage man, fetching a nice price after splitting the money with Nayakpuk. Earlier this year, the state reopened Sitka's public assistance office to the relief of many. That's because while the office was closed, the welfare caseload became severely backlogged. KCAW's Emily Kwong reports on the domino effect that followed, putting local food pantries to the test.
Blossom Twitchell pulls back a curtain, revealing 10 feet of shelving.
We do have crackers and rice and noodles and chili.
Twitchell is a caseworker for Sitka Tribe of Alaska's Social Services Department, and this is STA's pantry. 3 weeks into August, when this interview was recorded, the shelves are mostly bare. Here's Twitchell.
A lot of people are using their food money to pay utilities and rent and cost of living expenses. So we are seeing a spike in our numbers.
As a result, what used to last a month at STA's pantry now lasts a week and a half. And Twitchell thinks she knows why. In June 2017, the state closed SICA's public assistance office. That's where locals could walk in the door, apply for benefits, and have a technician on hand to help navigate the system. The closure was the result of attrition. It made financial sense to the state in an era of budget cuts. The Juneau office took over SICA's caseload and did what it could to keep up with demand, but eventually the backlog grew and grew and grew. SICAns were losing their food stamps, which are renewed every 6 months, and Twitchell says they were going hungry.
A lot of people would call the Juneau office and they would get a machine. And when you're in that moment of needing assistance and needing answers to what they needed to do to get back on, they weren't finding the answers.
The state ombudsman investigated the Division of Public Assistance and found out that their backlog had ballooned to 20,000 applications. That report was released in May of this year. And in June, to the relief of many, the state reopened SICA's public assistance office. I visited the new space, now housed in the same building as SICA's trial court. Applications are still processed elsewhere, this time in Ketchikan, but the two local positions have been rehired. There have been other positive changes. The legislature approved funding for 20 new public assistance positions, and the department is working on a statewide delivery model that would allow technicians to process applications from anywhere in the state. As you can imagine, Twitchell is relieved.
It's not such a bottleneck now, but it definitely hit SICA hard and it hit families hard.
STA wasn't the only pantry cleaned out. SICAns Against Family Violence has seen their stock dwindle. And Salvation Army has been hit especially hard. They are the biggest pantry in SICA, cycling through 10,000 pounds of food a month. But it's not enough to meet the need in SICA.
Hi guys, how's it going today?
Hey, how are you?
Major Charlene Morrow moves through the dining area as steam rises from bowls on the table. It's lunchtime. In the past year, their data shows that clientele at the soup kitchen has nearly doubled. The pantry can't keep up. So Salvation Army spends $600 a week on groceries to keep the shelves full. Clients aren't just homeless individuals, but families and senior citizens.
Is it hard for those families to come to Salvation Army for the first time?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we have a lot of people that, you know, come in tears because they're embarrassed or they're ashamed. As a person that grew up with a single mom that relied upon food boxes, I know that embarrassment and that shame is there, but we try to make it so that it's not embarrassing, that it's not shameful.
Their mission is built around the idea that anyone can fall on hard times and that times right now are especially challenging. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Raven Alaska. Raven serves Alaskans in over 115 communities across the state from Valdez, Utqiagvik, and more. Information at flyraven.com. Lead is bad for the health of Alaskans, especially for young children. It affects developing brains, so even small amounts are unsafe. Lead can be hiding in older paint, workplaces, ammunition, fishing weights, aviation gas, and marine paint. If you think you or your child has been exposed, ask a healthcare provider about testing. Get the lead out, Alaska. Learn more at leadfree.dhss.alaska.gov. This message brought to you by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Veterans Affairs officials in Alaska want to provide Homer veterans with more health services and a larger clinic. But there's a hang-up. In a trend seen around the state and its large veteran population, the estimate is that only half of the overall numbers of vets are signed up for insurance through the VA. And without more registered vets, it may be harder to justify additional services. Dr. Timothy Ballard is the director of the Alaska Veterans Affairs Healthcare System. Ballard says that there's an estimated 90,000 veterans in Alaska, and potentially having less than half of them registered is a roadblock standing in the way of any attempt to expand services in the state.
So it's very difficult for my mental health care providers across the state to be able to help these veterans out if they're not being seen, if we don't have information on them, if they're not actively using the system.
Currently, the Vet Center, another branch of the VA, provides monthly mental health services in Homer, while the VA itself provides healthcare services a few days per week at South Peninsula Hospital. Alaska VA spokesperson Sam Hudson says the VA put in the paperwork to build a standalone clinic in Homer. Hudson says the VA is working to register more people in the Homer area.
This is not your father's VA. We're much different. We're much better. Are we perfect? Absolutely not. But are we getting better? Absolutely.
Hudson says they are making progress. Now it's almost a requirement for people who are separating from the military to sign up for care. This summer, Alaska's Energy Desk is bringing you the second season of the podcast, Midnight Oil. This season is focused on one of the biggest challenges facing the state. That's climate change. Today, oil companies on Alaska's North Slope are dealing with on-the-ground problems related to rising temperatures, like shorter ice road seasons. But the oil industry is also grappling with climate change on a much higher level. Elizabeth Harbaugh from Alaska's Energy Desk reports.
This spring, ExxonMobil held a meeting with investors.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. If I could ask everybody to go ahead and take a seat.
It didn't generate many headlines, and that's a little surprising, considering what Exxon was there to talk about, climate change.
This was the first time that Exxon had ever held a session devoted entirely to carbon, as they called it, but to the larger issue of climate change.
Amy Harder is a veteran energy reporter who used to work for the Wall Street Journal, and now she's with Axios in Washington, D.C. She follows how oil companies are strategizing around climate change, and Exxon's meeting got her attention.
You had Darren Woods, the CEO of the company, there talking directly with analysts about this very issue.
We believe that we have an obligation to help address this challenge. We also believe very strongly that we're part of the solution.
The purpose of the meeting was to explain to Exxon's investors how the company fits into a world where climate change not only exists, but where people are trying to do something about it. There was one moment towards the end of the meeting that sticks out. An analyst piped up about a policy called a carbon tax. That's a well-known idea to combat climate change. And it's actually something Exxon supports.
I have a cheeky question. I've assumed that Exxon's support of a carbon tax is very savvy. I think it's a very good message for the company to send, but equally, it's likely because you don't think a carbon tax will ever happen. Is that fair?
There was an awkward pause. Then one of Exxon's top managers says,
no. Short answer, no.
And Darren Woods, who was sitting off to the side, sort of stood up and became animated. And it was the most animated, you know, an oil executive could be, talking about why they are advocating for a carbon tax.
There is a cost of carbon in society today. It's an implicit cost. It's hidden. And so our view with a carbon tax is making it explicit is a much more effective way.
Yes, that was the CEO of Exxon acknowledging that climate change is a cost to society and advocating for a carbon tax. Now, you don't see climate activists jumping up and down about this. Exxon's take-home message was its oil and gas business is going to be just fine, even in a world that's trying to confront climate change. Setting that aside, though, Harder says that Exxon's meeting even happened is a big deal, that its investors were there asking tough questions about climate policy and how it could affect Exxon's business model, and that the CEO was there taking those questions on, that's telling.
They're accustomed to dealing with, you know, what reservoirs around the world have the most oil and oil prices and all these other things that really have nothing to do with climate change. So the fact that they were steeped in it, to me, was an indication that climate change is a very big issue from a business perspective for Exxon and other big oil companies.
And it fits into a larger debate in the oil industry right now. For decades, the world's hunger for oil has generally steadily ticked up. And in response, companies have found and produced more oil to satisfy that demand. But now there are hints of change.
Andrew Logan is with Ceres, a Boston-based nonprofit that works with investors and companies, pushing the business case for environmentally friendly practices.
What's changed in the last year or two is that, you know, the industry now, for the first time in its history, is worried that, you know, after a century and a half of growth, global demand for oil may peak and eventually decline. And that is a remarkably fundamental shift for these companies.
The Trump administration may be pulling back from climate policy, but most of the rest of the world isn't. The renewable sector is growing rapidly, and the world is getting a lot more efficient in how it uses fossil fuels. So some big oil companies are talking about a day when the world's demand for oil stops growing. This year, one such company, Norway's Statoil, made a big announcement proclaiming it was taking oil out of its name.
Say hi to change. Say hi to Equinor.
It's reshaping itself as an energy company, not just an oil company. Equinor projects oil demand could start to decline by 2030. Now, there's a big asterisk. All oil companies, including Equinor, agree demand for their product isn't going to dry up anytime soon. The world goes through a staggering amount of oil every single day. And as giant economies like China and India grow, even more energy will be needed to power them. Looking to the future, the oil industry is trying to figure out how to balance that with the world's equally pressing need to deal with climate change. Logan from Ceres says there's no doubt the world is going to need a lot more energy.
I think the real question is, what form will that energy take, and will it necessarily be fossil fuels? And that's where I think the risk of the industry being wrong is greatest, and is the greatest threat to the long-term financial health of these companies.
It is impossible to know how this will play out. The energy industry is notoriously unpredictable. But if the climate change issue does lead to a decline in oil demand, Logan argues companies that branch out from oil sooner rather than later are going to look really smart. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
That story is part of the podcast Midnight Oil, The Big Thaw from Alaska's Energy Desk. To hear the rest, go to alaskapublic.org or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Finally tonight, a correction to a story Friday about fuel reaching the North Slope by barge. It was not the first time ever, but the first fuel barge delivery there in decades. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Rasha McChesney and Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Emily Kwong in Sitka, Renee Gross in Homer, and Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by BP, investing in Alaska by hosting local interns and donating to University of Alaska programs like the UAA Summer Engineering Academy. More at bp.com/Alaska. Lead is bad for the health of Alaskans, especially for young children. It affects developing brains, so even small amounts are unsafe. Lead can be hiding in older paint, workplaces, ammunition, fishing weights, aviation gas, and marine paint. If you think you or your child has been exposed, ask a healthcare provider about testing. Get the lead out, Alaska. Learn more at leadfree.dhss.alaska.gov. This message brought to you by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.